What began as a harvest celebration between European settlers and indigenous communities nearly four centuries ago has become our cherished tradition of Thanksgiving. This day's roots are intertwined with those of our nation, and its history traces the American narrative. Today, we recall President George Washington, who proclaimed our first National Day of Public Thanksgiving to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many and signal favors of Almighty God, and President Abraham Lincoln, who established our annual Thanksgiving Day to help mend a fractured nation in the midst of civil war. We also recognize the contributions of Native Americans, who helped the early colonists survive their first harsh winter and continue to strengthen our nation. From our earliest days of independence and in times of tragedy and triumph, Americans have come together to celebrate Thanksgiving. That's the opening of a Thanksgiving Day proclamation by President Barack Obama. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What's myth and what's fact in our American history of Thanksgiving? What did presidents like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln include in their Thanksgiving Day proclamations? How have religion, football, and business played a role in our Thanksgiving Day practices? Joining us to talk about Thanksgiving over the centuries is Charles Cohen, UW Professor of History and Religious Studies and the Director of the Lubar Institute for the Study of the Abrahamic Religions.
Welcome back to University of the Air. It's been a few years.
Thank you very much for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
That quotation from President Obama, let's see, it touches on religion, the harvest tradition of Thanksgiving. Inevitably, there's going to be a political angle there and, of course, nationalism. And we can't help wondering, too, about the commercial aspects of Thanksgiving, all of these rolled into one rather unusual holiday.
Yes, I think, Norman, you've touched on what I see as the many layers of this holiday. I think for us as participants, that makes it particularly rich. For a historian, it keeps me busy in my job, trying to identify what I think are the various elements that have gone into this. We don't have a holiday that's full sprung. It's rather a historical development.
And begins, at least according to the word, the name of the holiday, it begins as a religious phenomenon?
Yes. I mean, you can go back in England at least as far back as the 14th century, where people call days of Thanksgiving for particular events. And again, the earliest manifestations of this part of the tradition are that it's occasional. We are now accustomed to, well, it's a movable date, but it moves within a very, very strict time limitation. But originally, Thanksgivings in the religious sense were days to thank God for something very particular and very important that had recently happened.
Well, one of your areas of specialty is colonial America. And we always think of the origins of Thanksgiving going back to something about the pilgrims. Often there will be little pageants and skits with Indians and pilgrim hats and all kinds of things. And what do we really know about what happened?
Well, there's only one eyewitness account, and it's one paragraph in Mort's Relation. Mort was the author of that document. And it tells us that people began to gather. It tells us about the natives being there. It doesn't give us a specific date. And it lets us think, I think with good reason, that what is going on in Plymouth in 1621 is not what I'll call the religious tradition, but rather the second element in all of this, and that is the English harvest home.
Harvest home meaning?
The harvest home is a harvest festival. It's a time to celebrate, you know, in the autumn, the fruits of the harvest. It's a time of merrymaking and of feasting and eating. And much of what we consider, quote, traditional Thanksgiving fare, and there have been a lot of interpretations of the silences in the historical record, But basically, it goes back to what is an English yeoman's diet with a few holiday additions. So pies, frumenty, which is a kind of porridge. You might in England have had cheeses. Again, it's not necessarily high fare, but it is substantial fare. And that's the second part of this holiday that's been grafted in, the celebratory feasting part. But originally, again, in 1621, this was not part of what I've called the religious tradition.
Well, you know, we always think of 1620, but presumably they waited until 1621 because that was the first good meal they'd had.
Well, I mean, this particular band arrives, first of all, in November of 1620, and, you know, then they kick around and finally get to Plymouth in December. So they're not planting anything. I mean, it looks at a distance as if this is a, quote, Thanksgiving in the religious sense for a good harvest. But the way in which it's described is absent all of the sort of providential accoutrements that we would expect if this were the religious Thanksgiving. The description makes it look very much like an English harvest home. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the pilgrims didn't pray at some point. It's hard to imagine them not doing that. But in 1621, to say that that is Thanksgiving in this contemporary sense is wrong. It was not.
How about the sort of development of the idea of proclamations about Thanksgiving? How do we get from sort of these early colonists to a situation where you have presidents weighing in?
Well, the proclamations, even in the 17th century, are coming from the civil government. Churches might advise, and I should say that even individual churches, for that matter, individual families might call their own Thanksgivings. But, and we're talking about really Massachusetts and Connecticut, these kinds of proclamations are, in their genesis, somewhat political. They are called by the civil arm, again, on recommendation of the churches. But it is the civil magistrates who actually call it. And so the notion, indeed, the process of a Thanksgiving Day being called by proclamation goes back even farther than the 17th century. But in Anglo-America, it does come out of the civil arm in the 17th century.
Where does it start to catch on in other parts of the, well, let's say the colonies?
Well, it drifts a little bit southward in the 18th century, again, less tied to a kind of political theology that really grounded it in 17th century New England. But by the 19th century, many states in the South have adopted it, even though, particularly as issues over slavery heat up, there's a very powerful impulse on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line to separate themselves from each other. So Southerners don't want to acknowledge the Puritan background, if you will, and Northerners don't want to acknowledge John Smith and Pocahontas. But the fact that the Confederate government issues its own Thanksgiving and, for that matter, fast day proclamations as well indicates that that political theology has caught on in the South as well.
Now, that's a concept that we're not as familiar with today, I suppose, most of us, the fast day. How is that the other side of Thanksgiving?
Yes. I mean, fast days or days of humiliation and fasting are the other side of the coin. They both, at least in this Anglo-American sense, come out of a particular theology that suggests that providence, you know, God's providence orders the world and things happen for good reasons that are very reflective of the moral universe. So that when something wonderful happens, it is your duty to thank God who gave you that benefaction. And when something horrible happens, the way to right that is to repent your sins and ritually humiliate yourself. And one of the ways of doing that is to fast.
Why would Jefferson Davis be interested in a fast day? Was that just part of the Confederate experience anyway?
Well, he does it actually at the beginning when things are going quite well. And for that matter, Lincoln does it as well, though he doesn't call as many. And Davis has a particular sense of, I think, reviving a national covenant. What's behind the political theology of fast days and Thanksgiving days is the idea that the nation is in covenant with God. This obviously goes back to notions of Israel in Jewish scriptures.
The chosen people.
Right. And so by the time you get to the Civil War, there both sides are claiming to be the chosen people. So Davis appropriates what's been developing a bit on the national level and takes it over for the South. And this theology then suggests that there is a national covenant and that one's behavior towards God is quite important in maintaining that. If God blesses you, you certainly want to thank the Lord for those blessings. And if things go awry, there's a good chance it's because you have sinned and therefore you need to repent.
Is there worry early on that Thanksgiving Day feasts will lead to gluttony? I mean, we think of Thanksgiving as everybody overeating, which seems to get pretty close to the gluttony problem.
As far as I can tell, that's not a concern. And again, if we go back to this separation, Thanksgiving originally is a religious Thanksgiving that is marked by celebration, but not particularly by feasting. The harvest home, the fall harvest celebration, if you will, is when you celebrate and feast. And, you know, Anglo-Americans were hardly alone in being people who in pre-modern times, when you have a surplus, you should take advantage of it because you don't know when you might not have one. And the odds are by March you won't. Before refrigeration, even with salting, et cetera, there's a tendency to
seize the moment.
Yeah,
right.
And
it's several moments, as it turns out. I mean, we're used to a day, but a harvest home could go on for several days.
And what about the idea that some of the American narrative about Thanksgiving was an attempt to gloss over or sugarcoat what had happened with the Indians? In other words, if we create a story about it that involves people coming together and everything's wonderful, does it become a kind of, I don't know, a way of hiding something else?
Well, it can be. And indeed, you know, among the many things that creep through my mailbox daily, I just got something from some individual on that line that this is all a way of hiding what's gone on with Native peoples and that there shouldn't be a holiday like this at all. I think that misreads 1621, and I think it also misreads the development of the holiday, which isn't to say that Americans haven't done terrible things to Native peoples. The 1621 narrative that I would put out is that you have 50 or so colonists, men, women, and children, who have managed to survive. They've lost 50% of their population. The Wampanoag band that comes to them consists of 90 men. Now, who is the stronger in that situation? And it is marking an agreement between Plymouth and the Wampanoags, who are quite happy to add what is, from their perspective, another local band into their alliance network because they're afraid of the Narragansetts, who are a larger band to their west, and it would be nice to fortify themselves against that. So I wouldn't want to overly romanticize 1621. The Pilgrims, as far as we know, didn't send out engraved invitations. The Wampanoags dropped in because their sense of hospitality was, we're friends. If we happen into your territory, then it's your duty to be hospitable. They also, by the way, and this we do know because it's documented, is that they go out and kill deer. So they bring a very important contribution to the feast. And deer, I think, for people of the middling orders in Plymouth would have been quite a treat, since in England they would have been caught
for poaching.
Deer lived on the game reserves of the aristocracy, and you just didn't have it. So again, I wouldn't want to romanticize 1621, but I wouldn't want to undervalue it either. If it's anything, it's a suggestion of what relations could be in the 17th century, though they weren't always, and perhaps in a kind of wistful way, what might have been. The natives are more than equals at Plymouth, in my sense, in 1621.
But it sounds like from the get-go that Thanksgiving had a political component, because the Wampanoags are welcoming the pilgrims, as we call them, as part of a political power structure.
Yes. I mean, it may go too far to call this a diplomatic banquet. And again, it's not framed that way. In my reading of the documents we have, it's a harvest home into which the Wampanoags introduce themselves and then are more or less welcomed.
All right. So then exactly who are the people, the Europeans who are celebrating this harvest home in 1621? Who are they?
Well, they're the survivors of the Mayflower, again, who have lost in the previous winter half of their population. So it's a ragtag band of English people, some of whom had lived in Holland in prior years and were probably very thankful just to be alive and able to eat.
But came for purposes of religious freedom. That's why they were in Holland, too, was to get away from some persecution, political or religious, in England?
Yes, certainly religious. These are separatists, which is to say, whereas most Puritans in the early 17th century wanted to reform the Church of England but to remain within the Church, these are people who believe that the Church of England is utterly corrupt and that they need to separate from it now. And that's a very dangerous position, because it's not only a religious issue, but it's an issue of really treason, because the head of the Church of England, of course, is the king. So in the end, I mean, the logic is, if you don't say you don't want to belong to the Church of England, then you are in some sense committing treason. Elizabeth executed a few separatists the decade before, so the Scrooby Church, which holds to these principles, does go to the Netherlands. They kind of sneak back into England because they have a deal with someone, Thomas Weston, who will get them to North America. They don't have the wherewithal on their own to do it. But yes, politics insinuates itself as well.
We're going to look at George Washington and some other early proclamations that come out about Thanksgiving when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland and our guest Charles Cohen. We are talking about Thanksgiving over the centuries. In his proclamation, Barack Obama refers back to George Washington. So take us there. What does our first president do in terms of making Thanksgiving into something of a national moment?
Well, even the nationalization of the holiday takes time. It's actually the Continental Congress that issues the first proclamations. The first one is 1777. It comes shortly after the Battle of Saratoga, which is a huge American victory. It will ultimately result in France's entry into the war. And then Congress issues one for each year until 1784, and then they stop. Washington in 1789, in his first term, indeed in the first year of his first term in the new government, issues one. And that sort of sets the template, though it doesn't by itself establish the tradition.
What does he say?
Among the things he says is, and also that we may then unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and ruler of nations and beseech him to pardon our national and other transgressions. So there's a little hint there of the fast day. To enable us all, whether in public or private stations, to perform our several and relative duties properly and punctually, to render our national government a blessing to all the people by constantly being a government of wise, just, and constitutional laws discreetly and faithfully executed and obeyed. Interestingly, he says at the beginning that both houses of Congress have requested him to recommend to the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer. So very early we get this sort of process, if you will, that Congress asks him to make a proclamation. And the language is very, very Washingtonian. Great Lord and ruler of nations, the beneficent author of all the good that was. I mean, this is more the language of rationalist or Enlightenment Christianity than it is of evangelical Christianity. And that, for the most part, becomes the sort of, I almost said statuesque language of how one addresses God in these proclamations.
What was the upshot of it? I mean, did Thanksgiving then get a kind of a shot in the arm from this proclamation by Washington? Do we have a sense that suddenly there are more families or institutions observing the occasion?
Well, I don't think there's any way to know, and my hunch is that it had absolutely zero impact, which isn't to say that Thanksgiving wasn't already being celebrated or that it was continually being celebrated. Indeed, we're focusing now on the day as a national holiday, and it has become that. But it was, again, originally, well, both a local, a provincial one, an even more local one because localities, churches could call these Thanksgivings. And in its celebration, it continued to be local throughout the 18th century. In other words, Thanksgiving and by the 18th century, these two earlier strands of the religious and the harvest home have begun to almost imperceptibly merge. Thanksgiving didn't need to have a national proclamation in order for it to continue. I think if one did a historical counterfactual, one could imagine local traditions continuing on their own and we might have a variety. I think part of the story of how the holiday we have now comes to be is that it becomes nationalized and Washington's proclaiming it in 1789 is part of that story. But in 1789, there is absolutely no inevitability about it. Indeed, Washington doesn't make another such proclamation until 1795. And then neither Adams, who issues a couple of, interestingly, fast day proclamations, and Jefferson, who is steadfast against issuing these proclamations because of his own views of, as he says, the separation of church and state, we have to wait until James Madison, late in his second term, to find another one. And then presidential proclamations really drop away until the Civil War. So although there are national aspects of this, it didn't have to happen.
When does the turkey creep in? Because we call it Turkey Day sometimes, but you don't get a sense that that even was part of those early meals necessarily.
Well, in 1621, again, we know they had deer. They talk about fowling. They don't say what they shot. I think turkeys, you know, become traditional in part because that's what New Englanders had. In this context, it might be salutary to remember that although the bald eagle is the national bird, Benjamin Franklin didn't want it to be because he thought it a creature of bad moral comportment and, and lousy as well. And he advocated the turkey, which he said had greater moral comportment and presumably was cleaner. I don't know if that exactly encouraged it, but I think, you know, the turkey can be the centerpiece of a feast and was in many places. And so again, this becomes conventional because of local usage. And it's not, after all, the centerpiece in every diet. Anyone who likes perusing through food magazines or food websites or shows knows that there are regional variations on Thanksgiving that don't require a turkey at all. But it's the New England-centeredness of the sort of public observance that makes the turkey so important.
And I guess cranberry is also a New England thing, because it's very big in Wisconsin, too, much later.
Well, and Wisconsin, some people, myself included, would see it culturally as part of, quote, greater New England. It's mm-hmm. least it's where New Englanders, some New Englanders migrate
sure, yes.
in the 19th century.
The Yankee tradition in Wisconsin, yeah.
And I'm sure weather and lakes have something to do mm-hmm. with that as well.
Now, you said James Madison was, you know, the one that issued more proclamations. Did he add anything to the discourse?
Not particularly. Madison issues his in 1815. He does it really after the Battle of New Orleans. So although most of these proclamations tend to be towards the latter part of the year, he issues his in March of 1815. And in that sense, he goes back to the older occasional tradition because he has a very specific event in mind. I mean, this is coming right after the Battle of New Orleans, which, even though the peace treaty with Britain had been signed earlier, really solidifies the end of the war and makes Americans feel that they've really won it when, up to that point,
they were always in danger of some kind of incursion by Britain or somebody.
Yeah,
else.
And the best one could say is that this was a draw. So Madison trots this out at that point, and then we don't have another proclamation until the 1860s.
Well, it makes sense to have Lincoln issuing one in terms of trying to pull people together. I assume that's why he got involved.
He has one in 1862, but it is the 1863 one that sets up the annual or perpetual tradition. And many people, with some cause, give a great deal of the credit to Sarah Josepha Hale, who had been conducting a campaign for decades to have Thanksgiving become a national holiday. Hale is a New Englander. She is editor of, I want to say, the Red Book or the Cosmo of its day, Godey's Lady's Book. I mean, she's a very important female intellectual and cultural figure in mid-19th century America. And she has been campaigning for Thanksgiving in part for the domestic virtues that it will inculcate. And this reminds us that, after all, these celebrations, while they may be publicly proclaimed, are, as we take them now, private or familial affairs. They may be large gatherings, depending on your family, but they are private as opposed to happening in public space.
Yeah, they're not civic events, are they?
Not, I guess, in their ceremoniousness or the way in which we celebrate them, although I suppose going to football games, which does go back to the entertainment or the recreational parts of the harvest home. So that's perfectly in keeping. Part of the celebrations, I think, do occur in public spaces. But that's right. Given the religious dimension of this, we might expect it to occur in houses of worship. But it doesn't.
Why Thursday for Thanksgiving?
Again, I think that becomes conventional. I've never discovered a clear reason why Thursday, though Thursday, even when you go back to the early proclamations, that seems to be the preferred day. Again, that itself is a change because in the original tradition, it's occasional. It could be any day of the week to mark a specific event. And even some of the earlier ones are not always on Thursday, but for some reason, Thursday became conventional.
So what did Lincoln actually say in his proclamation? He didn't peg it to Thursday?
Well, in 1862, he doesn't, but in 1863, he does. And that's the one that historians of Thanksgiving cite as being the sort of ur document for what we have now.
And does he ground his proclamation in sort of religious language, the way we heard in George Washington sort of referring to an enlightened Lord of all?
Yes. In fact, I should say in 1863, Lincoln issues two Thanksgivings. The first is sort of the usual one. Well, it's actually more an occasional one, I should say. He issues it on July 15th. So it's right after Gettysburg and Vicksburg.
Big Union victories that solidified the Union cause.
So he begins that one. It is pleased Almighty God to hearken to the supplications and prayers of an afflicted people and to vouchsafe to the Army and the Navy of the United States victories on land and on sea so signal and so effective as to furnish reasonable grounds for augmented confidence that the union of these states will be maintained, their constitution preserved, and their peace and prosperity permanently restored. The Union is going to win, boys, with God's help. Now, the next one he gives, the one that really starts this tradition, is in some ways more reflective and much more theologically supple.
And that's the one from 1863?
Well, that's
later?
The second. Right. That's the third day of October. And so he issues it on the same day that Washington issues the 1789 one. So there's a very conscious link to Washington's proclamation, and that would be done for political and historical significance. But he starts at the year that is drawing toward its close, has been filled with the blessings of fruitful fields and healthful skies. He talks about the ever-watchful providence of Almighty God in the midst of a civil war of unequaled magnitude and severity, which has sometimes seemed to foreign states to invite and provoke their aggression. Peace has been preserved. But then he goes on, no human counsel hath devised, nor hath any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gifts of the Most High God, who, while dealing with us in anger for our sins, hath nevertheless remembered mercy. And so then he invites his fellow citizens in every part of the United States to celebrate in November. And I recommend to them that while offering up the ascriptions justly due to him for such singular deliverances and blessings, they do also with humble penitence for our national perverseness and disobedience, commend to his tender care all those who have become widows, orphans, mourners, or sufferers in the lamentable civil strife in which we are unavoidably engaged, and fervently implore the interposition of the Almighty Hand to heal the wounds of the nation and to restore, if as soon as it may be consistent with the divine purpose, to the full enjoyment of peace, harmony, tranquility, and union. And so, in some sense, he's including the Confederacy as well. This isn't so much Thanksgiving in the full flush of victory as the earlier one is. It's maybe this is all going to end and we can come back together. Lincoln saw more deeply, I think, than most of the observers, and that goes for clerical observers as well, of his day, into what the trauma of the war was doing to all sides.
Lincoln really then cast a long shadow in what Thanksgiving is going to be for future generations. I mean, that really defined it, except, you know, I think it's a much more strongly religious theme than most people would realize. It's almost like he's setting up this contract with that Almighty in terms of, yes, we've been bad, but just work with us. It seems to be what he's saying.
Well, I share the view of many historians of Lincoln that he's our most theologically adept president, even though, I mean, people will argue, well, he had deistical leanings. He never really was part of any particular church,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. And yet in this, you can get that sense in the Gettysburg Address. You certainly get it in the second inaugural address, that he sees providence at work, but it's not the easy providence that is favoring our side or punishing us with a loss. It's a larger providence that is affecting and sometimes afflicting everyone, and even in the midst of victory.
And so he sets Thanksgiving for when?
Well, he sets it then for the last Thursday of November, which is the last Thursday before Advent, you know, which begins then in December. So even in that setting, he has I'll call it an ecclesiastical or a ceremonial sense that's in a way greater, I think, than his own particular religious tradition.
Well, we're going to talk about 20th and 21st century Thanksgivings and the role of football and business when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Charles Cohen, who's filling us in about Thanksgiving as it has gone down through the ages. When we get into the realm of these annual or more or less annual proclamations, presidential proclamations about Thanksgiving, do they tend just to reflect kind of the preoccupations of their times?
Yes, there's usually some little line that is contemporary or very self-referential. As an example, William Howard Taft, 100 years ago this year, 1910, gives a very, very perfunctory proclamation. We wouldn't really remember it for any reason. But in the midst of it, he says how it is especially to be noted that during the past year, great progress has been achieved in the case of arbitration and the peaceful settlements of international disputes. And arbitration treaties were the foremost part of Taft's diplomatic agenda, so he's giving himself a nice pat on the back.
I would think it would have been hard for Herbert Hoover to talk about Thanksgiving during the Depression.
Indeed. 1932, of course, is the depths of the Depression, and so you have to wonder, what is Herbert Hoover going to do? How can he put a happy face on the Depression?
He's already been voted out of office.
So he's a lame turkey.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's done on the 3rd of November.
Election Day,
so
give or take
about
a day. Yeah.
And what he or someone in his staff does is really brilliant. He just says, I do further recommend, as usual, that we celebrate this. And, oh, by the way, it's now 200 years since the anniversary of George Washington's birth. So why don't I just cite Washington? And then what he does is to insert Washington's original proclamation into his so that it basically becomes Washington's proclamation.
That's a way to get out of talking about the Depression. What about FDR? How does he handle his approach?
Such a mover and a shaker and an iconoclast.
Well, one of the things that Roosevelt does, we know in 37 he comes up with his court packing scheme. And 2 years later, he does something that is in its way as radical and gets him in a great deal of trouble. The language of it is pretty routine. There's more than three centuries ago. There's the season of the gathering and the harvest. He gives thanks to the ruler of the universe. And then what he does is to set the date for the fourth Thursday in the following November. And that's the radical change, because the tradition had been that it was the last Thursday. Well, in 1939, November had five Thursdays, and Roosevelt moved the date back a week in order to lengthen the shopping season. And this gets us to maybe the final layer of the five that I talked about, and that's commerce. Now, the early proclamations all talk about God favoring, you know, agriculture and manufacturing and commerce. So there's at least a diffuse sense that the economy is worth observing. But early in the 20th century, and I think we can point to R.H. Macy and company, and in the 1924 Macy's, originally it was called a Christmas parade, but they marched on Thanksgiving, as the time at which Thanksgiving becomes very, very much a marker, at least, of commerce.
The opening salvo of the Christmas season.
Yes, exactly. And so this is in full swing 15 years later when Roosevelt moves the date of Thanksgiving up a week in order to lengthen the shopping season. I mean, that's the only motive that he has for doing that.
And who objects?
And whose idea was it? You think it was Macy? Was Macy talking to Roosevelt and suggesting this, or was it just kind of in the air?
That's a good question. I don't know if there was a specific person who spoke with him, but the idea that there would be a very short shopping season that year was certainly in the air. So we don't have to attribute it to any one particular person. Well, Roosevelt catches huge flack for this, and some of it comes from the business community. So Charles Arnold, who runs Arnold's Men's Shop in Brooklyn, New York, writes that the small storekeeper would prefer leaving Thanksgiving Day where it belongs. If the large department stores are overcrowded during the shorter shopping period before Christmas, the overflow will come naturally to the neighborhood stores. Needless to say, people who make calendars are not particularly thrilled since they've already printed those. And this one's going to hit close to home as well. The Athletic Board of New York University writes that over a period of years, it has been customary for my institution to play its annual football game with Fordham University at the Yankee Stadium here at New York University on Thanksgiving Day. As you probably know, it has become necessary to frame football schedules 3 to 5 years in advance. And for both 1939 and 1940, we had arranged to play our annual football game with Fordham on Thanksgiving Day. So lots of people are upset about this. And, of course, it becomes a congressional issue.
I would have thought religious leaders might object that it was commercializing the holiday. But it sounds as if it's just people objecting that maybe it's getting in the way of schedules and small business. Right. But no one complained to him about it sort of almost putting the priority on the money-making.
Right. And in part, I think it's because at this point, it's not that religion has been read out of Thanksgiving. It hasn't. But if the original Thanksgiving, the religion, what I've called the religious tradition, is to mark particular occurrences, by the time that you've, in essence, routinized it, the holiday is detached from celebrating any particular event and for giving thanks to God for that event. So in a sense, the date doesn't matter very much if what you're doing is thanking God for sort of general blessings. It does matter, though, if you have a football game scheduled on that day.
So it becomes sort of a feeding frenzy of a different kind, doesn't it? It's more like a shopping feeding frenzy.
Well, and it becomes that. But just to give a historian's perspective on how these things are created and then I think uncreated, my sense is that since the 1970s, Thanksgiving has begun to lose its preeminence as the signal for the Christmas shopping season.
Yeah, now
season.
It's Labor Day.
Well, I wouldn't have gone that far, but I think yes. At the very least, it's Halloween. And I think Halloween has become much more important as a holiday in the past 30, 35 years so that it can, if you will, take the weight of being that signal moment. Not that Thanksgiving's commercial aspect has disappeared entirely, and certainly the holiday is very rich. It's not that Thanksgiving is going to disappear. But I think the mix of the things that we've been talking about has varied over time. And I think there's a very important and basic historical lesson to be learned from that.
I opened the hour with a little bit of the 2009 Thanksgiving Day proclamation by Barack Obama. Do you want to talk about that one? It seemed to have quite a mixture of things brought up in it.
It is. I found it really fascinating, both for the way in which it evokes those proclamations that have come before, but also for where it differs. He starts off by saying what began as a harvest celebration between European settlers and indigenous communities nearly four centuries ago has become our cherished tradition of Thanksgiving. This day's roots are intertwined with those of our nation, and its history traces the American narrative. So he goes back to the past, which is what everyone does. He then invokes George Washington, who proclaimed our first national day of public Thanksgiving. Okay, we can leave the Continental Congress out of this. And President Abraham Lincoln, who established our annual Thanksgiving Day to help mend a fractured nation in the midst of civil war. And then he says, we also recognize the contributions of Native Americans who helped the early colonists survive their first harsh winter. Well, he has Plymouth in mind, and continue to strengthen our nation. So here's an evocation of Thanksgiving that has all the traditional ones, Washington and Lincoln, and also mentions indigenous communities. I have to believe that's the first time that phrase was used in a Thanksgiving Day proclamation. But he's reading natives into the story. And I think to a great degree he's right, but it's fascinating that he does it.
It's also intriguing, now that I think of it, that from the beginning, and including in Obama's proclamation, Thanksgiving has been a multiculturally inclusive celebration.
Yes. He says, as Americans, we hail from every part of the world. While we observe traditions from every culture, Thanksgiving Day is a unique national tradition we all share. And again, I think he's right. It's not that American Thanksgiving is a unique Thanksgiving in the sense it's the only one. There are plenty of Thanksgivings. Native peoples don't need this. They had their own harvest festivals and so on. But as I hope we've sort of illuminated in this discussion, it's the way in which the American holiday has become constructed over the centuries from all of these different traditions and from historical contingencies that has made it what it is. And to my mind, one of our most and maybe even the most important civic holiday. You know, in the 19th century, the 4th of July was the American national patriotic day. It's not so much now. It comes in summer. It's a good day for barbecuing or going to a baseball game. But, you know, I bet George Washington gets invoked more in presidential Thanksgiving proclamations now than he does on the 4th of July, which might be more appropriate. So I think it is the way in which our history and culture have constructed this holiday that has made it so important for us.
I find it interesting that Obama goes on to talk about also using the day to reach out and give fellow citizens in need of a helping hand some assistance. And there has also been this tradition of Thanksgiving of food drives. And that was in some earlier thing you read, too, a little bit of an acknowledgement that Thanksgiving could be a time of meeting needs of those without.
Right. Well, Lincoln, certainly.
With widows again, and so on.
Yes. And you're right. I mean, the communalism of the holiday does extend to food drives. And this is a day in which we want all Americans to participate. And those who can't because they're on the street or for whatever reason, it's very nice. Our cultural and religious institutions have really on their own. Again, this isn't a top-down directive. I think the spirit of the day has really infused the ways in which such organizations have tried to make it a truly national and truly comprehensive holiday.
And a thing unto itself. Our guest has been Charles Cohen. Thanks for guiding us through the ages as Thanksgiving develops and continues to develop here in America.
Well, thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Thank you. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, Charles Cohen will be our guest, and with him we'll be looking at that great American tradition, Thanksgiving, through the centuries, how it's changed. You might be in for some surprises. Right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.